The following talk was recorded at LibrePlanet 2021 Empowering Users, the annual conference on current issues in ethics, social justice, and technology from the Free Software Foundation. LibrePlanet is a live conference, and speakers often use slides and other visual tools to assist their presentation. You can see the videos of these talks at media.libreplanet.org or on the FSF PeerTube channel. LibrePlanet speakers do not represent the mission of the Free Software Foundation. We host speakers talking about their use of free software in different kinds of political and commercial work. The FSF supports their freedom, but does not take positions on any political issues other than those necessary to uphold the principles of free software. Like all the FSF's work on behalf of the grievance of all computer users, LibrePlanet is made possible by thousands of individuals. To keep our work going, please consider becoming an associate member via my.fsf.org/join or making a donation at my.fsf.org/donate. You can stay informed by subscribing to our newsletter, The Free Software Supporter, at fsf.org/fss, and for more information on LibrePlanet, you can visit libreplanet.org/conference.
Hi everybody, my name is Amanda Sopkin, and today I'm going to be talking to you about labor movements and the free software community. When I originally came up with the idea for this talk, I was planning on mainly focusing on the ways that the free software community can help labor movements. But the more research I did, the more I found that there's actually a lot of interesting philosophical overlap. So I'm also going to be exploring the lessons that the free software community can take from organized labor. So I want to start out with this quote from Richard Stallman. He said, "Value your freedom or you will lose it, teaches history. Don't bother us with politics, respond those who don't want to learn." So kind of as a quick disclaimer, the content of this talk is going to be somewhat political, if you didn't guess that already based on the title. So quick note on terminology. Many of you are probably familiar with this concept already, but just want to review it. I'm going to be mainly using the phrase free software as much as possible, except for if I'm referring to a specific quote from someone else where they specifically said open source or a product that doesn't meet that definition. The definition of free software is software that ensures that the end users have freedom in using, studying, sharing, and modifying that software. And it's free as in free speech, not free of charge. Open source, on the other hand, is defined as software for which the original source code is made freely available and may be redistributed and modified. So technically speaking, these definitions probably sound very similar to you, and that's because they are very similar. The main difference is really more ideological. So open source, the literal meaning is less philosophical. It basically just means that the source code is openly available to read. Free software, on the other hand, the literal meaning is more easily misinterpreted to mean something involving cost, but the actual meaning is much more philosophical. And you might also see me use the acronym FLOSS, which stands for Free, Libre, and Open Source Software. So without further ado, I want to give you kind of a roadmap of where we're headed. I'm going to start out by talking about similarities between the philosophy of organized labor and the philosophy of free software. I'm going to talk about tactics used by organized labor, specifically in the United States. The content for this talk was very big, so I had to scope it down a little bit to just the US. I'm going to talk about the rise of free software. I'm going to talk about why people give their labor willingly to work on free software. And I'm going to talk about the internet and its impact on organized labor at the end. So I want to start out by talking about philosophical similarities between the free software movement and organized labor. And I'm going to explore some of those overlapping themes by looking at quotes from leaders in the organized labor community and leaders in the free software community. So this first one up top, we have a quote from Samuel Gompers, who was the longest serving president of the American Federation of Labor. He said, "To be free, the workers must have choice. To have choice, they must retain in their own hands the right to determine under which conditions they will work." And on the bottom, we have Richard Stallman. "Value your freedom or you will lose it, teaches history. Don't bother us with politics, respond those who don't want to learn." This is the same quote that I used just a few slides ago. This is a recurring theme. It's about the importance of choice in your life. In the context of the labor movement, this means choice in how you spend your working hours. And in the context of the free software community, it means choice in the different tools you use and exactly how that information is used. Next big theme is the importance of community. This first one is from Sue Carney, the former director of HR for the American Postal Workers Union. She said, "At the core, labor unions are working men and women, unified as one force. Despite any personal differences that may exist between us, we have banded together to protect and improve the lives of workers. We rise up together for the greater good. We defend one another like family." And then on the bottom from Richard Stallman, "If you focus your mind on the freedom and community that you can build by staying firm, you will find the strength to do it." So both of these are talking about the importance of having a group of committed individuals to your cause. The first one even goes so far as to use the word family. So these people might not be people that you agree with everything on, but they're people who are committed to the same purpose, which is very valuable. And this last one is about the importance of applying pressure through numbers. This first one is from A. Philip Randolph, who was a labor unionist and civil rights activist who organized the March on Washington. He said, "Nothing counts but pressure, pressure, more pressure, and still more pressure through broad, organized, aggressive mass action." And on the bottom, Richard Stallman, "The most effective way to strengthen our community for the future is to spread understanding of the value of freedom, to teach more people to recognize the moral unacceptability of non-free software. People who value freedom are, in the long term, its best and essential defense." So again, we have this idea of building a strong community and bringing more and more people into that community in the interest of one day accomplishing your goals. So now I'm going to talk about the tactics used by organized labor in the United States and what they were able to achieve through use of those tactics. So what exactly do I mean by organized labor? This quote is from Theodore Roosevelt. He said, "No man can be a good citizen unless he has a wage more than sufficient to cover the bare cost of living, and hours of labor short enough so after his day's work is done, he will have time and energy to bear his share in the management of the community, to help in carrying the general load." So I think this introduces a core concept of organized labor really effectively, which is this idea that as a person, you have limited working hours. And ideally, you don't want to spend all of those working hours just trying to make enough money to survive. Ideally, you should also have time left over to spend in the pursuit of your own interests and in helping your community. So organized labor as a concept is kind of born out of that desire to bargain for more time in that way. And I'll also talk about labor unions. A labor union is an organization that acts as an intermediary between its members and the business that employs them. So it'll bargain on the behalf of this collective of workers to try and achieve things like higher wages or shorter working hours, for example. And that's necessary because those are generally at direct odds with the employer who's looking to increase their profits. So now let's talk about tactics. These will probably sound familiar. Definitely the most popular one is the strike, which is the withholding of your labor in the interest of a particular demand. This image is from the machinist strike at Boeing in 2008. During the strike, they had 27,000 people strike in the interest of several demands, including increased wages. And they were able to accomplish those demands through the strike. This image is from the writer's strike in 2007-2008. In particular, this is an image of them picketing. Picketing is gathering near an institution, typically holding a picket sign, with the purpose of informing other people about your cause. And it's often combined with the strike to kind of maximize the effect of the strike. And in particular, it can be helpful on cases like this because if you're gathering in a high traffic area, people will generally be reluctant to cross the picket lines. You can inform more people about your cause. And in this particular case, they were picketing at 14 specific studios in Los Angeles. And then third of all, we have the boycott, which is when a group of people refuse to buy a company's products because of something they're doing. This tactic is used by the AFL, which maintains a national don't buy or patronize boycott list. And in 2003, the production of Miss Saigon was added to that boycott list because of some unfair labor practices and then also some racism concerns. So these people are picketing outside of Miss Saigon, but there was also a boycott in action. And then the fourth tactic I want to talk about is just this concept of community building, which is super important for organized labor in general. And it's the idea of engaging deliberately with communities to get more and more people to learn about your cause and eventually participate. And this image is from the West Virginia teachers' strike in particular, because a lot of people felt like community engagement was really core to the success of that strike. So now I want to talk about the opposition facing organized labor so that we can kind of contextualize organized labor in the United States. This is two different facts, one of which is from the Bureau of Labor Statistics and one of which is from a favorability survey on unions by MIT. And in 2018, 48% of non-union workers said that they would join a union if they could, but just 10% of workers actually belong to a union today. So it's clear that there's some kind of disconnect there, and I think some of these anti-union tactics or trends explain exactly why that disconnect exists. So according to the Economic Policy Institute, employers as a collective spend $340 million per year on union avoidance consultants in the United States. And that doesn't count the money that they spend doing the things that the union avoidance consultants tell them to do, like, for example, running advertising campaigns against unions. That's just the money that they're paying people to help them figure out exactly how to block the formation of a union. So, popular anti-union tactics include forcing employees to attend mandatory daily anti-union meetings, plastering the workplace with anti-union posters, banners, and video ads. And then using managers or supervisors to tell employees that there's a good chance they'll lose their jobs if they unionize, hold one-on-one talks to stress why it would be bad for them to vote in a union, tell employees that pro-union workers are the enemy, and also grill subordinates about their views on unionization, which can really kind of minimize the desired impact of having a secret ballot if your manager is constantly trying to figure out exactly what way you're going to vote. And those are legal tactics. Another big source of opposition that labor unions have to deal with is how they're covered in the media. So this is from a study by the Frameworks Institute on teacher strikes in 2012. They looked at the tone of different stories about the teacher strikes, and they found that 56% of the stories were critical, 24% were neutral, and just 20% were outright supportive of unions. So when it comes to media coverage, usually the biggest hurdle is just getting the media to cover your strike or your boycott or your picket. But after that, the next struggle is getting the media to cover your strike or your boycott or your picket in a positive way. So in that same study, they found that the shallow, stereotyped, and overwhelmingly negative coverage of teachers' unions places them in a defensive position against the national news media. So that's a big struggle for organized labor in the United States, even when they can organize a strike movement. Another kind of source of opposition, or one of the obstacles facing organized labor in the United States, is union favorability, which is also a result of some of these tactics. This graph shows union membership since 1985 all the way to present day, and you can see it's been on a pretty steep decline. This next graph is a survey on favorability of labor unions. And you can see that the approval rating, it goes, I think it spikes in around 1960, and then it starts to go down and reaches its lowest point in 2010, and then has been kind of on the upturn in the last 10 years. And again, some of the reason that this favorability trend exists, or some of the tactics that we've talked about earlier, all of the forces facing labor unions in the United States. And this is also an obstacle that unions have to get past. So now I want to talk about achievements of organized labor. Starting with around the turn of the century, a lot of big achievements around early 1900s. The first big one is that 36 states adopted workmen's compensation in the period from 1912 to 1918. And in addition to that, several states adopted other measures like allowing one day's rest in seven, putting limits on night work, limits on the workday, and minimum wage laws. So the workmen's compensation one is big because this means that workplaces were required to provide some kind of financial reward if someone was injured doing work on the job. And then later in the 1930s, we get another set of big achievements. The 40-hour work week was codified, and then that included overtime pay required over 40 hours. The federal minimum wage was established, and then we get also the abolishment of child labor. So if you work in the United States today, these are pretty crucial things that we kind of take for granted as parts of the landscape in which we go to work. And then another big thing achieved by labor unions kind of collectively is increased safety regulations. And I think one of the numbers that shows this best is this one. In 1913, 23,000 workers died on the job. And in contrast, in 2017, 5,000 workers died on the job, despite, you know, the monumental increases in population in that 100-year period. So that's a reflection of lots of different kinds of laws, and also the birth of OSHA in the 1970s. So as I've talked about a little bit already, there's been a big decline in labor union membership. Workers covered by a union went from 27% in 1979 to 11.6% in 2019. This is even worse in the private sector. In 1953, 35% of private sector workers were covered by a union. And in 2015, that number is 6.7%. So pretty severe drop. So what's the effect in this decline? There's a few trends that I'm going to talk about here. Obviously, they can't be specifically isolated to the decline in labor union membership. I think it's more like a bunch of different factors that have caused these problems, or this rise in inequality also contribute to the decrease in labor union membership. So CEO compensation has grown 940% since 1978. In contrast, typical worker compensation has risen only 12%. CEO compensation in 1965, to give you an idea, was 20-1. So CEOs still made 20 times what a typical worker would make. But that's inflated a lot. It went all the way up to 58-1 in 1989, and then to present day numbers, 278-1. So it's inflated pretty drastically. Another good one I like to look at is the average annual work hours. So what's interesting about this chart, as you can see that in 1979, the U.S. was one of the better countries on this list. And then it had a very small decline in the following 30-year period. So that puts it at the worst of the list of countries in 2015. Compared to other countries like Germany that saw a much steeper drop of 40%, much bigger decline in the number of work hours. And that's partly a result of that decrease in labor union membership that we've talked about. So when it comes to the future of organized labor, like I said, union membership has been on a steady decline, but some bright spots are teacher strikes, which have won some important gains over the last 3 to 5 years. Initiatives like the fight for a $15 minimum wage kind of show how unions can put their weight behind a ballot measure and fight for that. And then there's also been some increases in union favorability that hasn't been reflected yet in an increase in union membership, but hopefully it will. So now I want to talk about the history of free labor and open source software. So switching gears almost entirely. In the 1950s and 1960s, software actually mirrored close to what we might think of as free or open source software today. It was public domain by default, and the human readable code was naturally distributed alongside the machine executable. In 1955, we get the Share Users Group, which was a volunteer-run IBM users group that maintained a library of free and open source software that people could use. In 1969, we get the first version of the internet, which made sharing source code a lot easier. And in that same year, we get the United States brought a case against IBM, alleging that bundling software was anti-competitive. In this particular case ended up actually being thrown out altogether in 1982. But it's still significant because it's one of the first notable times when this idea of copyright was attached to software. And sure enough, 5 years later in 1974, the United States Commission on New Technological Uses of Copyrighted Works decided that computer programs were subject to copyright, which is unfortunate. And then kind of as a result of that decision, in the 1980s, there's this trend to only release the machine executable and not the human readable code. In 1983, we get the GNU project, which was an initiative to allow people to work on a computer where all of the software would allow people the rights to use, share, study, and modify every single piece, including the operating system itself. 2 years later, in 1985, the Free Software Foundation was established as almost like the philanthropic arm to do more advocacy for free software alongside the GNU project. In 1991, the Linux kernel was released, which was a really natural complement to the existing GNU project. And then in 1998, there's this kind of rift in the free software community, which resulted in the formation of the Open Source Initiative. So basically, kind of short version is that some people in the free software community felt that the term free software was confusing and wanted to create a term that was more understandable, but also more marketable to corporations. So that's how the Open Source Initiative came about. And people in the free software community felt like it wasn't capturing the original philosophical inspiration. And that's why that remains separate to this day. So now I want to talk about growth in free software development and use over really the last 5, 10, or 15 years. This quote is kind of a good introduction. This is from Mark Suster, who is a managing partner at Upfront Ventures, which is the largest VC firm in Los Angeles. And he says, "When I built my first company in 1999, it cost $2.5 million in infrastructure just to get started, and another $2.5 million in team costs to code, launch, manage, market, and sell our software. The first major change in our industry was imperceptible to us. It was driven by the introduction of open source software. Suddenly, infrastructure software was nearly free. We paid 10% of the normal costs for the software, and that money was for software support. A 90% disruption in cost spawns innovation, believe me." So he's describing kind of the big difference between starting a company in 1999 and then later on being able to rely upon all the existing free and open source software to start a company. This quote also reflects the growth of free software in general in the last 5 to 10 years. In the 2015 Future of Open Source survey, they found that 78% of the 1,300 companies surveyed said that their software created for customers was built on open source, which is nearly double what it was 5 years prior in 2010. So what exactly has caused the growth of this movement? A couple of factors that I want to talk about on the developer side are the rise of Git. So this shows the prevalence of Git versus SVN. You can see that in 2009, SVN was a lot more popular, and since then that trend has sort of reversed itself. GitHub provides a very intuitive user interface for developing free and open source projects, which makes it easier to participate in that kind of work in general. I think another trend that has made it a lot easier to develop free software is the growth of websites like Stack Overflow. So this is kind of one of the famous answers on Stack Overflow. I know not everyone loves Stack Overflow, but in general, it is a very useful source of information on doing software development. And other tools like that or tutorials have made it a lot easier in general to learn to code and work on code, even if you don't have a formal education. This graph shows the growth of source lines of code. They looked at 5,000 active and popular open source projects to make this, and you can see that the contributions have really skyrocketed just in that time period from like 1999 to 2007. So what do we do with this growth in free software? What exactly does that mean for the world? It means a lot of really great stuff. Just want to give some examples of digital infrastructure that we rely on that runs on free software. In the State of Enterprise Open Source report, they found that 56% of companies expect their use of containers to increase, and 78% of those companies said that they prefer Kubernetes, which is a free software containerized solution. OpenSSL is a popular software library for security communications over networks, and it's got almost approaching 50% of its market share. So the majority of websites with HTTPS are using OpenSSL, which is huge. And then also Firefox has 250 million users. So those are just some kind of big flashy examples of free and open source products that we rely on almost probably every single day if you're visiting an HTTPS website. Another thing that free software does is it makes it a lot easier to start a company. So that's reflected in the earlier quote from Mark Suster, but also Alan Schaff, the founder of Imgur, has famously said that the only money he spent in starting the company was $7 to purchase the domain name. And that was only possible because of the prevalence of free software available to kind of build out something approaching an MVP and actually attract customers to that without spending any money. And then finally, and perhaps most importantly, free software ignites people's passion in technology. So a lot of boot camps rely really heavily on free software tools to do development. And a lot of people teach themselves to code by using free software tools. This is a quote from Aubrey Eshright describing what it was like to learn to code in the late 1990s. She says, "I wanted to learn to program, but I didn't have money. Not the college student version of not having money. My family situation was low income, but also highly chaotic. This is going to seem strange to anyone today, but at the time there were basically two options for someone who wanted to write real software. You could use a PC with Windows and pay extra for Microsoft's development tools, or you could have access to a Unix system and use GCC. So my goal became to get access to accounts on Unix systems so I could learn how to write code and do cool stuff." So that kind of shows the impact of the growth in free software. It's kind of become the norm for how software is distributed and also software development tools. And that makes it a lot easier to learn. So just to quickly summarize, what we get from free software, it kind of provides digital infrastructure in general. We're using it every single day in the way that we browse the web and many of the products that we use. It makes it a lot easier to start a company. So big advantage there for in entrepreneurs. And it also ignites people's passion in technology. So now I want to describe some of the tactics that the free software movement is using to further its cause. Kind of three big pillars, I would say, that the Free Software Foundation and other groups are working on are education and awareness, which I know is quite broad. That can mean anything from exposing security issues in proprietary software to maintaining lists of good free software projects. Another big one is the GNU project and the GNU general public license. So doing evangelism around that and getting more people aware of those tools. And then also community building is a big part of the work for the Free Software Foundation, including events like this one. So I thought it was interesting to explore the tactics used by the free software movement and kind of compare those to organized labor. Education and awareness is kind of broadly similar to a picket in that you are spreading information about what you're working on and your cause. The GNU project and the GNU general public license are similar to a boycott in that you're essentially refusing to use proprietary technology because it doesn't meet your standards. And then community building, that's the fourth tactic that we talked about in regards to organized labor. And that's an essential piece of building any movement really, but in particular for organized labor and for the free software community. So now I want to talk a little bit about the sustainability of work on free software. And in order to shape that conversation, I want to talk about a famous vulnerability. So I'm going to talk about the Heartbleed vulnerability in OpenSSL as a very quick timeline. In 1998, a group of developers created OpenSSL, and it became quite popular. As of 2014, 2/3 of the web encryption software depended on OpenSSL. which is astronomical. And in that same year, the Hartley bug was discovered and reported to OpenSSL on the 1st of April of 2014. And they were able to get a fixed version of OpenSSL out that same week on the 7th of April in 2014. But this particular bug had a big impact on the world. This is a quote from Joseph Steinberg, who is a cybersecurity columnist for Forbes. He said, "Some might argue that Heartbleed is the worst vulnerability found since commercial traffic began to flow on the internet." So although they patched it relatively quickly, there were still a number of high-profile attacks. I think potentially the biggest one was an attack on Community Health Systems, which is the second biggest for-profit hospital chain in the U.S., which compromised 4.5 million patient records. So some other facts about the development of OpenSSL. The founder, Marques, did not take a salary at all, put a ton of time and energy into not just working on the product, but also marketing it and taking care of business stuff, and did not take a salary for any of that work. And the gross revenues for the product as of the time that Heartbleed happened primarily went to security-related testing. So as a result of that, they only had enough funding left over to pay one developer full time. So if you can put that into perspective, that means 2/3 of the world's web traffic was essentially relying upon one full-time paid developer. So with that context, this quote from the founder of OpenSSL says, "The mystery is not that a few overworked volunteers missed this bug. The mystery is why it hasn't happened more often." And I think that definitely applies if you think about all the work that goes into a project like that. It's a marker of true success that there weren't more bugs and it hasn't happened more often. And this is another quote from Marques. He says, "I'm looking at you, Fortune 1000 companies, the ones who don't have to fund an in-house team of programmers to wrangle crypto code and then nag us for free consulting services when you can't figure out how to use it. The ones who have never lifted a finger to contribute to the open source community that gave you this gift. You know who you are." So this kind of gets into the problem of producers versus consumers. So you have a ton of consumers, basically the whole world on the web, relying upon this one particular piece of technology. And you have relatively few people putting back into it or actually producing free software, which leads to this imbalance. And that can be, there's a harsh light thrown upon that imbalance when vulnerabilities like the Heartbleed vulnerability happen. And then it can be kind of tempting to look at this problem and say, well, of course we should pay these people more. The solution is to put a ton of money into this project. I want to take kind of a step back. And again, I have another quote from the founder of OpenSSL. He says, "These guys don't work on OpenSSL for money. They don't do it for fame. They do it out of pride and craftsmanship and the responsibility for something they believe in. It takes nerves of steel to work for many years on hundreds of thousands of lines of very complex code, with every line of code you touch visible to the world, knowing that code is used by banks, firewalls, weapon systems, websites, smartphones, industry, government, everywhere, knowing that you'll be ignored and unappreciated until something goes wrong. There should be at least a half dozen full-time OpenSSL team members, not just one, able to concentrate on the care and feeding of OpenSSL without having to hustle commercial work. If you're a corporate or government decision maker in a position to do something about it, give it some thought. I'm getting old and weary and I'd like to retire someday." So obviously there is a problem of unpaid labor here, but I think kind of what Marques is saying is that people don't just work on really successful free software projects for money or even for fame. There's a lot more that goes into it than that. So why do people work on free software? There's a paper that explores this topic called The Simple Economics of Open Source that basically argues that people work on free software because they get kind of monetarily equivalent advantages like experience and prestige. I think the reality is a little bit deeper than that. This is a quote from David Heinehammer Hansen, who created the popular software framework Ruby on Rails. He says, "Open source has been such an incredible force for quality and community, exactly because it's not been defined in market terms. In market terms, most open source projects should never have had a chance. Take Ruby on Rails. That's a monumental achievement of humanity. Thousands collaborating for a decade to produce an astoundingly accomplished framework and ecosystem available to anyone at the cost of zero. Take a second to ponder the magnitude of that success, not just for Rails, of course, but for many other and larger open source projects out there with an even longer lineage and success. It's against this fantastic success of social norms that we should be extraordinarily careful before we let market norms corrupt the ecosystem. So again, before just deciding like, oh, we should make this a market and then pour money into this problem, I think it's important to look at what the free software community has really been able to accomplish, because it is, in David Heinehammer Hansen's words, a monumental achievement of humanity that projects like this exist. So why do people work on free software? Experience and prestige are factors for sure, but then there's also the community aspect. It's extremely meaningful work, and some people use the products that they work on and take great pride in making those better. So what might a more sustainable free software community look like? That's not the purpose of this talk, so I want to touch on it briefly, but not spend too much time. These are some of the options that are generally put forward when it comes to addressing this problem. I think, in my opinion, the worst one is the corporate donations or bounties one, which would potentially give corporations a lot of undue influence on free software projects. Some other suggestions include subscription-based funding, kind of pay-to-play, foundation-based support, which would kind of introduce an intermediary where maybe Facebook isn't paying for free software specifically, but they're paying a foundation that puts money towards causes like that. Just having companies structure some kind of free software development into work time. Some corporations maintain full-time teams whose job is to work on popular free software projects. And then also crowdfunding. There's been some successful projects that relied on crowdfunding as well. So again, this isn't the purpose of this talk. I wanted to kind of touch on it briefly. But I really want to say is that I think in our capitalist world, you kind of take it for granted that your work is equivalent to the money that you get for it. And I think really successful free software projects show us that that's not true. The money you get for your work is not necessarily equivalent to the value of your work. And neither of those things are equivalent to your value as a human being. So now I want to talk about what free software can do to support the labor movement. There is this concept of open source unionism, which was first introduced in 2002. This is a quote from a piece in The Nation. The internet reduces to near zero the marginal cost of providing information, advice, and some direct services to members. And net usage in America is approaching 80% of households or workplaces. What that means is that unions can be continuously communicating with even a vast membership at a cost that is basically independent of the number of members. Servicing and coordination of a mass labor movement, drawing on membership more varied and dispersed than present membership, is economically feasible today in a way it was not just a few years ago. So obviously that percentage has gotten even higher. I think it's something like 90% of households today. And you might be wondering exactly how this played out. It has played out to the success of organized labor in some cases. This is a quote from Ryan Frankenberry, who is one of the organizers of the West Virginia teacher strike. And he said this strike wouldn't have happened without the grassroots organization through the private Facebook group. So this strike in particular relied very heavily on organizing through tools like Facebook. And I'm going to talk about why it's not great that it's Facebook specifically in a little bit, but that kind of shows the potential to magnify the voice of labor movements through the internet. So three ways that the internet can benefit organized labor are by increasing engagement with their members, making it easier to get updates or send feedback, more effective organizing tools that are more broadly available, and also providing just a louder voice or a broader platform for organized movements like a strike. So the big downside of using the internet or other software tools for organized labor is the surveillance that comes with using a lot of those tools. So I'm going to talk about workplace surveillance. In a 1993 survey of large corporations, 22% admitted that they spied on their workers with some form of electronic surveillance and never told employees they were being monitored. And by 1999, that number had doubled to 45% of employers. And the latest surveys in 2018 show that 67% of employers use some form of electronic spying on employees. So incredibly prevalent today. I think this fact was particularly shocking for me. A survey by the Bentley Center for Business Ethics found that 25% of employers allow information technology staff to look at other workers' internet activity and personal emails for any reason. And 25% is a relatively low number, but what this statement is actually saying is pretty shocking. It's saying that they're allowed to look at other workers' internet activity and emails for any reason. So I'm almost positive that there are other companies that might have a slightly stricter standard, like maybe you need to provide a reason, that still provides similar kinds of surveillance in the workplace. So how does this translate into organized labor? Companies absolutely will use this surveillance to crack down on organizing efforts. This quote is from Ian Gold, who is a director with the Teamsters. He says, "Walmart did get a lot of heat for its labor practices, but I think it's been supplanted by Amazon. Amazon has taken spying on workers and trying to understand workforce behavioral trends or predilections to the next level." So if you're wondering if companies will use these tools to your disadvantage, the answer is absolutely yes. Companies will use tactics like monitoring email, even monitoring social media activity off the job, and mapping anti-union sentiment based on your location as well, to kind of highlight areas for potential in organizing and try and crack down there. So here's a quote from the executive director of the Free Software Foundation, John Sullivan. "Massive privacy intrusions like this are to be expected when people shift from storing their media locally and using local software to storing them in other people's servers and using hosted web applications. Giants like Microsoft, Facebook, and Google are vulnerable to government requests for user data, and there are better, more secure ways to share information online. Free software projects are hard at work creating a less centralized world where users retain control over both their media and the software used to access it, while still getting the social and convenience benefits of the giant centralized and compromised services." So what he's kind of highlighting there is the work done by the Free Software Foundation, which can ideally allow workers to get the same benefits of doing organizing and having a broader platform on the internet without the serious downsides of surveillance. So ultimately, if you take one thing away from this talk, the fight for free software and the fight for organized labor are ultimately about the fight for freedom and control of our lives. And whether that's the specific tools that we're using in the case of free software or the ways that we spend our waking hours, they're both about having more choice in our lives and kind of fighting back against the influence of corporate greed. So if you want to get involved, I wanted to highlight some relevant projects that you can support. Hack the Union is a website that documents the intersection of technology and the labor movement. The Fatal Encounters database is a project that's trying to document all examples of fatal police encounters from January 1st, 2000 in the United States and onwards. And Portside is an independent news organization that collects stories on labor activity. So you can support, patronize, and get involved in those initiatives if you are interested. And then there's a lot of work to be done in terms of free software advocacy. So some things you can do are find good ways to measure the usefulness of free software so that people are more aware of exactly how much we rely on it. Encourage the adoption of standards and free software compliant licenses in your work and the work of your friends. And then you can build awareness in your circles as well. There's a piece written by Richard Stallman that talks about how to support the free software movement. You don't have to immediately start using only free software tools, but even saying just one no to using a proprietary technology tool and instead opting for a free software tool can make a big difference. So I try to look at it that way. Instead of, you know, just trying to quit cold turkey, it's good if you can say no even just one time. And you can encourage your friends to do that as well. So I want to leave you with this quote from Eugene Debs, who is the founder of the Industrial Workers of the World. He says, "As long as he owns your tools, he owns your job. And if he owns your job, he is the master of your fate. You are in no sense a free man. You are subject to his interest and to his will. He decides whether you shall work or not. Therefore, he decides whether you shall live or die. And in that humiliating position, anyone who tries to persuade you that you are a free man is guilty of insulting your intelligence." So I think he does a really good job there of highlighting, as long as he owns your tools, he owns your job. And if he owns your job, he is the master of your fate. Thank you for coming today, and have a good rest of your conference.